to start our April board meeting. And we're going to start with insurance, and I understand we are first going to discuss paper 2C, sweep issues. Agit.
So agenda paper 2C, this paper discusses additional stakeholders' concerns relating to IFRS 17, which have arisen in the project of the amendments to IFRS 17. This paper also includes an issue that relates to stakeholder concerns about IFRS 9 as well. So our plan is to introduce each topic separately and allow you to discuss and make a vote for each topic. So the first topic is about the effective date of the proposed amendments to IFRS 17. The board developed the proposed amendments and set the timeline for finalizing those amendments to ease implementation process of IFRS 17. Therefore, aligning the effective dates of the standard and the amendments is appropriate. The staff think that once the proposed amendments are finalized, entities should be permitted to early apply the amended standard only, allowing entities to implement existing IFRS 17 requirements and then the amended requirements subsequently may impair comparability, add complexity for users of financial statements, and would not be consistent with the board intention. Based on this, the staff recommends the effective date of the proposed amendment should be aligned with the effective date of IFRS 17, so entities would be required to apply IFRS 17 and any proposed amendments for annual periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2022, and be permitted to apply IFRS 17 together with any proposed amendments for early period. I will now open up for the board to discuss.
Tak.
Thank you. I agree with staff's recommendation, but are you aware of any company who has already made early application for IFRS 17?
I'm not aware of any.
Right. What if there is a company who applied IFRS already? Do you require to restate the to meet the amendment? I mean, those who might have applied IFRS 17, they made a restatement from the previous insurance accounting. Then we made an amendment. Are we going to restate, require to restate again?
So I guess that if there would be a case that entities would apply now, which we are not aware of, or would apply early the standard before we finalize the amendments, we will need to think about specific transition requirements for the amendment. Since our outreach and discussions with preparers and stakeholders, we do not have information of early adoption of IFRS 17 or intention to apply it in the 1st of January 2020. We don't think we are in this situation, but I think it's a fair point. If we will be there, we need to think about that.
Yeah, okay. And also, so this is consistent with what you are proposing in this board table. Yeah. Okay.
Any other comments, Sue?
Just to say that I agree, and it's actually consistent with something similar we've done in the past. So, in IFRS 9, where we had various versions of IFRS 9 published. The last one, we didn't allow somebody to apply earlier versions once we'd finished.
Yeah.
That it seems to me it's a rather academic question.
Yeah. Okay.
If a company comes forward, he will receive a medal. Intelligence and courage. Okay. All right.
Do you want to vote on this one so we can move to the next one?
14.
Okay, so now move to the second issue. Some stakeholders are concerned with accounting mismatches that could arise between the effects of financial risks in the measurement of insurance contracts applying the general model and derivatives used to mitigate those risks. Such accounting mismatches might occur when an entity chooses to disaggregate insurance finance income or expense between profit or loss and OCI, while recognizing all changes in fair value of the derivative in profit or loss. Those stakeholders suggest the board should introduce a risk mitigation option for insurance contracts accounted for applying the general model. The staff recommend the board does not develop such risk mitigation option. The staff observed that an entity may avoid the accounting mismatch by choosing to include all of the effect of changes in financial risk in profit or loss, that in developing IFRS 17, the board already considered developing a bespoke solution for all hedging activities for insurance contracts and decided not to do so. And that the hedge accounting requirements in IFRS 9 or IAS 39 may enable entities to address some of these accounting mismatches. I will now hand over to the board for discussion on our recommendations. Thank you.
Mary?
A general comment that I think we should at this point have an incredibly high hurdle to introducing any more optionality or variation in the mix of possibilities within IFRS 17. So that while I understand the concern here, I think the fact that there's elections that allow people to avoid it and, may not be perfect, but that's the kind of thing you have to balance in making those choices outweighs for me the possibility of a accounting mismatch, because I go back to my beginning point. There are a number of alternatives offered within the standard, and I really hesitate in terms of the understandability of the outcome of applying the standard to introduce any further ones, unless there's really overwhelming evidence that it's absolutely necessary.
Any other comments? Do we agree with the staff recommendation?
14.
Okay, so issue number 3 is quite similar. This is about contracts that applying the variable fee approach and applying the OCI option and applying the risk mitigation option. So some stakeholders raised similar concern to those included in the second issue we just discussed, noting that if an entity chooses to apply the risk mitigation option and the OCI option, it will experience the same accounting mismatches because the application of both options will result in the effect of some changes in financial risk being recognized in OCI, and derivatives an entity uses to manage those risks are measured at fair value to profit and loss applying IFRS 9. The analysis we provided with respect to the second issue applies to this issue as well. This is because applying the risk mitigation option results in an outcome similar to applying the general model for the risk that the entity mitigates by using derivatives. The staff think that entities have available options to avoid accounting mismatches and therefore recommended the board not undertake any further action in this regard. Now I would like to open it for your discussion.
Do we agree?
14.
Okay, the fourth item is about reconciliations related to the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for incurred claims when cash flows are net settled. Some stakeholders noted that specific settlement agreements between reinsurers and insurers, or between insurers and brokers or agents, often include extensive netting arrangements under which all incoming and outgoing payments between the parties are settled net. Those stakeholders observed that for these types of arrangements, specific payments such as premiums and claims cannot be easily assigned to contracts and therefore to groups of contracts because cash systems are not linked to accounting systems. They observed that providing disclosure that distinguished between the liability for incurred claims and the liability for remaining coverage will require extensive allocation of cash flows. Those stakeholders suggested the board should amend the requirements of IFRS 17 to exclude amounts payable and receivable from the scope of IFRS 17 and include them in the scope of IFRS 9. At the December 2018 meeting, the board rejected an amendment that would require measuring premium receivables and claims payable separately from insurance contract because it would result in internal inconsistencies in IFRS 17. The staff observed that the information about claims development and about changes in the liability for incurred claims over the reporting period provide useful information to users of financial statements, regardless of whether the claims are settled directly by the entity, by others on its behalf, or net of premiums due. Therefore, the staff recommend the board not undertake any further action in this regard. Over to you.
Agreed.
14.
Thank you. And we will now move to the last issue that discusses a stakeholder's concern relating to IFRS 9. This relates to the restatement of comparative information when an entity initially applies IFRS 17 and IFRS 9 at the same time. The stakeholder says that an entity may wish to restate prior periods to reflect the requirements in IFRS 9. However, in the stakeholder's view, the transition requirement in IFRS 9 that prohibits entities from applying IFRS 9 to items that have already been derecognized may deter the entity from doing so. This stakeholder recommends the board amend this transition requirement in IFRS 9 to permit entities to apply IFRS 9 to items that have already been recognized. We note that the transition requirements in IFRS 9 and in IFRS 17 were subject to extensive deliberation and consultation. The board has already acknowledged that the transition requirements in those two standards are different. We also know that many entities have already transitioned to IFRS 9 and that the requirement related to derecognized items was applicable to the entities who chose to restate prior periods. Accordingly, we recommend the board not undertake any further action in this regard. I will now hand over to the board for discussion on this recommendation.
I agree with staff recommendation for the reasons that you've set out here, and maybe just to add a little bit of colour. So I was involved when this original paragraph was put into IFRS 9, and it was added in order to provide relief for preparers at the request of the banks at the time. And then later on in the life of IFRS 9, some of the banks came to us and said actually they did want to restate, and they would probably prefer to have what the stakeholders asked for, sort of the option of choosing to apply 9 or 39. And a decision was made internally at the time that not to reopen this because we were concerned about comparability and didn't think we could require people to apply 9 to everything and didn't want to have an option. So for me, this isn't a new request or a new issue. And given the complexity of IFRS 9, I would worry starting to unpick pieces of the transition requirements. And also, I haven't actually seen any evidence, even though it sounds appealing to have 9 applied to everything, I haven't seen any actual evidence of the problems that might arise from having the combination of 39 and 9 in terms of the effects on trend information.
I'm not disagreeing with the staff recommendation, but I think we should provide some more flesh to the discussion in our basis. First of all, to better understand the reasons for the request, because as it stands in the paper, it's the stakeholder may wish. So why would they want that? And also, the explanations that you give, Shira, I think should be present.
Any other comments? Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so if we move on to agenda paper 2D, this sets out some recommended minor...
D like David, B like boy.
D. D for David. And also 2E, actually. I'll talk about them both together. So... paper 2D sets out recommended minor changes to IFRS 17. These are changes that fall within the scope of the annual improvements process, but we plan to include them in the forthcoming exposure draft of amendments to IFRS 17 rather than as a separate AIPED. Paper 2D also explains why we're not recommending a further suggestion from some stakeholders related to one of the AIPs that the board tentatively decided to propose in June last year. Some of the recommended changes in Paper 2D have arisen from or are linked to submissions that the TRG has considered, and so Paper 2E sets out feedback from the TRG meeting last week on those changes. I'll look at the first two recommended changes together. They're in paragraphs 8 and 9 of Paper 2D. They relate to paragraphs B96 and B97 of IFRS 17, which sets out for the general model which changes in the fulfilment cash flows go to profit and loss or OCI and which affect the contractual service margin. And so in the general model, the effect of the time value of money and changes in financial risk doesn't adjust the contractual service margin, but there are two cases where we didn't manage to quite capture that in paragraphs B96 and B97. The first relates to investment components, and the second relates to the risk adjustment if that is disaggregated. So the recommended changes sort of put right what we should have got into B96 and B97. Just on the risk adjustment, that was something that the TRG discussed. So IFRS 17 allows but does not require the risk adjustment to be disaggregated between the effect of changes in non-financial risk and the effect of time value of money and financial risk. So paragraph B96 sets out the requirements for when it's not disaggregated, but it doesn't set out any requirements for what should happen when it is disaggregated. And our recommended changes say that if it is disaggregated, you take the effect of the time value of money and financial risk to profit or loss or OCI. One TRG member did not agree with that change because he thought that this meant that what he had regarded as a presentation choice in terms of not disaggregating was now becoming a measurement choice. But the staff think that the board had always intended that this relief of not disaggregating the risk adjustment was a practical relief that applied to both measurement and presentation. And if you didn't use the relief, then you would treat the measurement of the disaggregated effect of time value and financial risk in exactly the same way as you would for any other of those effects under the general model. And that's what this change recommends. So I'll stop there if you've got any comments on those two changes to B96 and B97.
Daryl?
So I agree with the staff recommendation, and I'm going to agree with it for exactly the words that you've just used, is that in principle what we should be doing under the general model is applying the general model as it stands at the first instance. As it stands at the first instance, financial variables go through profit and loss, and I think that's what this would require you to do.
Yeah.
And then that is definitely my view of what we introduced into the standard, was a relief to allow you not to have to disaggregate if the methodology that you used, well, because we accepted that the methodology that you used might not actually have a risk component to it. Now, it does result in a difference, but I think at the first instance, if you're doing it and getting an interest rate variable or have an interest rate variable that's part of it, there is no reason for me why you wouldn't do what we do everywhere else in the model. And if you're using the relief, you obviously don't have the number to do it, or you potentially don't have the number to do it, so you can't do it that way. So I agree with where we've landed. I do agree that it does result in a measurement difference between the two, but I think it's consistent with the idea of providing a relief.
Any other comments? Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14.
The third recommended change is in paragraph 10 of Paper 2D, and this clarifies that consistent with the hedging requirements in IFRS 9, that the use of the risk mitigation option in IFRS 17 can only be stopped if the criteria for using it cease to apply, not just because the entity decides it doesn't want to apply that option anymore. Any comments on that?
No. Assume we agree.
14.
The fourth recommended change is in paragraph 11 of paper 2D. It clarifies that the definition of an investment component, it clarifies to make it explicit in the definition that this is an amount that is repaid in all circumstances. Now, this is a question that came up at the TRG and was discussed at length by the TRG last week. Some TRG members expressed concern that this change that we're proposing was intended to narrow the definition of investment components, and some also expressed concern that it would result in additional analysis to comply in particular with the requirement in IFRS 17 that you have to disclose the investment component separately when a payment is made to a policyholder. We don't think that the clarification changes the intended scope of the definition. We think this just is a clarification of what we'd always intended that scope to be. We do think that we may need to amend that disclosure requirement because we hadn't intended that people should be doing more analysis beyond working out what you exclude from revenue and what you don't exclude from revenue. And so if some of the amounts you don't exclude from revenue comprise both investment component and something else, we weren't expecting people to do that analysis. And we'll bring back that disclosure as a sweep issue next month.
I agree with the staff recommendation. I thought the TRG discussion was interesting. It was helpful in terms of flagging in some places where perhaps people were overreading what I think the staff intended from this amendment, so that's important information. But what really struck me in that meeting was we had a sort of unusual combination of quite a group of people who felt that it was already obvious to them that these words were implicit in the definition, but then some who felt that it was going to change their analysis, which would suggest that they were applying it otherwise. What's been very apparent in all the TRG discussions that we've had that have touched on the definition of an investment component, we've always heavily relied on this reference to in all circumstances. So it's really fundamental to the understanding. So for me, while the standard's open, it's a very good opportunity to make it very clear that that's what the definition means without having to hunt in the basis and look at TRG logic to make it clear to people. And I think the other thing that was really striking to me in the TRG discussion was that I think certainly most, if not all, of the audit firms who spoke felt that there was a real need for this clarification in the definition to make sure that we had a better chance of people having a common understanding. So even if we'd had a situation where everybody in the room was agreeing that was how you should read the words, when the audit firms are talking to the bigger population, they definitely, I think, felt the need for the clarification, which I think is really important.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. First of all, I agree with staff's clarification. I think this clarification is very important and necessary, especially when we made that decision in January board meeting, because CSM will be allocated to those investment return services, provided that investment components was included in insurance contract. So this means that the identifying an investment component and clarify what's the meaning of the investment components is really important. I also appreciate the paper 2E, including those feedback from TRG meeting, really helpful, especially paragraph 6 and 7, clarify further about some issues raised during the TRG meeting. I remember that during TRG meeting, some members raised some concerns about distinguish between a refund of premium and an investment component, especially in some cases, the surrender amount may including, you know, a refund of premium. So whether they needed to be separate or not. So I appreciate the clarification. Paragraph 6, it said that identifying the amount of an investment component is only necessary at the time a payment is made to policyholder. I think it's very helpful. And also
paragraph 6 also said that a separate analysis of amount of an investment component and the refund of premium is not needed. So I would like just to confirm again that means if the amount used to determine the investment component, such as is the surrender amount, and that amount including a premium of a premium refund, that means the entity does not necessary to separate that premium refund from the surrender value, surrender value.
You don't need to do that to work out your revenue and expense. There, as I said, there is this disclosure requirement.
So only relevant disclosure
that we hadn't sort of focused on before, which we, now that it's been brought to our attention, we'll think about whether we need to amend that disclosure requirement so that you don't need to do this analysis simply for that disclosure requirement. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And also I think those clarification is really helpful, especially at paragraph 6 and 7. So I hope that in the future, the basis and conclusion of those annual improvements could include those, you know, explanation in the basic conclusion. I think those explanation will be very helpful for the entity to implementing of the clarification of the definition of investment component.
Daryl?
This is a bit of a piling on, but I just want to reemphasize a couple of things there because I thought they were really important. I thought that the TRG meeting was a very useful discussion around this, but I think it in particular highlighted that people had at least two different views about the words that were in the standard. And then I think as the discussion developed, it was clear that people who had read the words in the standard and then read the basis of conclusion were very clear of what the words of the standard meant, but that not everybody had got through to both. I thought it was also interesting that for most, maybe all the auditors who spoke in the session, they had clearly read both. And so that suggested that the interpretation that we looking to change now, or the words that we're looking to change now, would have got through eventually, but as people said, I think, and as you've mentioned, and I think it would have just taken a little bit longer to get there. So putting the words in the standard, so the standard is the place you have to go to, just makes absolute sense, and I don't actually think it's changing the outcome. I think it's just making the words easier. And then I would, and you talked about the disclosures and that the staff will think about coming back, I'd urge you to come back, because I think that was a valid point that was raised as well.
Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay, the next change is in paragraph 12 of paper 2D, and it's just a correction to make sure we don't push investment DPF contracts that are issued by an insurer out of IFRS 17 into IFRS 9. We always intended they would be in 17. So we, you know, just make the wording clear that they are in 17 and not in 9. Everybody okay with that?
Yep.
Good. The next one is in paragraph 13 of the paper, and that, again, it just corrects the omission of changes in the risk adjustment from the determination of the loss component. They should always have been included in those paragraphs, but they weren't, and now we're going to put them right so they are there. Okay, good. And then the final recommended change is in paragraph 14 of the paper, and that clarifies that changes in a participating insurance contract that are caused by changes in the underlying items, items that the participating contracts participate in, that these changes in the insurance contracts should be treated as changes in investment, i.e. as financial changes, even if the accounting for the underlying items themselves wouldn't treat those changes in that way. This was something that was discussed at the TRG. TRG members generally agreed that such changes in the participating contracts should be treated as financial changes for measurement purposes, but some thought they shouldn't be presented as financial changes. We think that the treatment for measurement and presentation should be consistent, and that it's consistent with the approach in the standard to how we regard participation in insurance contracts to treat these changes as financial, and that's what this amendment would achieve.
Agreed.
Thank you. Just clarification. Actually, I misread these sentences. And then your paper 2E made it clearer, so paper 2E was helpful. Mm-hmm. And the point I misread was the staff was trying to narrow down the scope of underlying item, because underlying items includes non-financial investment, and also it may include some other businesses, including insurance businesses. So underlying item itself is quite broad.
Yes.
But because of doing this, you are trying to assume the underlying item is basically the financial instrument investment, and also try to narrow the scope of variable fee approach. And then the company who is eligible for variable fee approach are those who are doing something like asset management company who is operating the asset management of financial instruments. But that is not your intention.
No,
we have to make it clear.
Yeah, we're not changing the scope of what could be underlying items for any type of insurance contract, whether it's variable fee or general model. The standard is very clear that underlying items can be any set of assets, any subset of the entity's assets. They can be. It's very broad, and this change does not in any way alter the scope of what could be regarded as underlying items, and it would not change the assessment of whether you met the variable fee approach scope.
And the thing is, this is only about presentation issue. There might be some mismatch of the presentation. Actually, on the asset side, there is some presentation in the profit and loss statement. Then the offsetting line item may be different, but the purpose is different, so that is okay. Is that what you intend to say?
Well, it affects contracts in different ways. For general model contracts, so indirect participating contracts, this would affect, if they weren't regarded as financial, it would affect the measurement, because they would adjust changes, would adjust the contractual service margin rather than being recognised in profit or loss or OCI. And everybody in the TRG agreed that that wasn't the outcome they wanted from a measurement point of view. So it isn't just presentation. But we think it is appropriate for both measurement and presentation.
Okay. Any other comments? Do we agree?
14.
Thank you. Are we going to put an explanation in the basis of why we think it is appropriate on that presentation point, along the lines of what you've got in 2E?
Yes, I will do. Yes.
So we've now covered a number of sweep issues and annual improvements, and although we expect some follow-up sweep issues, not least the disclosure that we mentioned earlier, we're now in a position where we've substantially completed the deliberations needed for an exposure draft of proposed amendments to IFRS 17. So the remaining papers for this meeting consider the proposed amendments as a whole, evaluates each of the proposed amendments against the criteria that you set for yourselves back in October, and considers the likely effects of the proposed amendments to IFRS 17, and that's relative to IFRS 17 itself. Agenda paper 2B also describes for you the due process steps that you've undertaken by the board in completing the narrow scope amendments to IFRS 17. So this package of papers does the thing we promised at the beginning, that we'd look at the package as a whole. We've got a couple of questions for you in paper 2B. First, we're asking you to reconfirm your tentative decisions on the mandatory effective date of IFRS 17 and on the fixed expiry date in IFRS 9. And we're asking this question not because we want you to debate it again, but because we said we would just circle around afterwards and check that the extent of the amendments that you're making are within the parameters you expected. We note that all the proposed amendments meet the criteria that you set, so we think that your tentative decision back in November is still valid. So in question one on page 3 of 2B, we're asking you to confirm that the board should defer the mandatory effective date of IFRS 17 by 1 year so that entities would be required to apply IFRS 17 for annual periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2022, and that the board should amend the fixed expiry date for the temporary exemption to IFRS 9 in IFRS 4 so that all entities must apply IFRS 9 for annual periods beginning on or after 1st of January 2022. And I'll let that come to you for discussion first before I move on. Any comments?
That is not the case, so I assume we agree.
14. So the second question is to ask you whether you're satisfied that the board has complied with the applicable due process steps and it should begin the balloting process for the exposure draft. And the due process steps are in Appendix A of this paper. Comments?
Agree.
14. And finally, I'm asking whether any board member intends to dissent from the publication of the exposure draft.
That is not the case.
Thank you very much, everyone. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.